Introduction to the Devout Life by St. Francis de Sales. Translated and edited by John K. Ryan. Neil Obstadt, John Tracy Ellis. Imprimatur, Patrick A. O'Boyle, Archbishop of Washington. Editor's Introduction. When Claude de Grenier, Bishop of Geneva, but with residence at Ancy in Savoy, requested the Holy See for a coadjutor in 1599, he submitted the name of one of his own priests, Francis de Sales. Although at that time only 30 years of age, Francis de Sales was already known in Rome. 2 years before, he had gone from Ancy to Geneva at the request of Pope Clement VIII to attempt the conversion of Theodore Beza, Calvin's associate and biographer, who was then in his 78th year. Clement VIII called Francis de Sales down to Rome for a personal interview. Before the College of Cardinals, with St. Robert Bellarmine and Caesar Baronius among those present, the Pope requested the future bishop, and at the end of the examination said to him, "Drink, my son, from your wellsprings and from your living sources. May these waters issue forth so that every one may drink his fill from them." It is not alone in the deeds that St. Francis de Sales performed in the remaining 23 years of his life, or in his character as a canonized saint, nor yet only in the religious communities that he has inspired, that the prophecy in the Pope's words has been fulfilled. The writings that the saint left behind him, the treatise on the love of God, the controversies, the defense of the standard of the Holy Cross, the sermons, the letters, the various minor works, and the introduction to the devout life have been wellsprings from which countless men and women have drawn light and strength. Particularly is this true of the introduction to the devout life. Great saints as well as lesser souls have learned from this book. Hither, as to their fountain, other stars, repairing in their golden urns, draw light. All of St. Francis de Sales' writings were produced to answer needs and demands that arose in the course of his life's work. Certain of his shorter works are pamphlets written to explain Catholic doctrine and answer objections to it. When he was attacked in writing for raising a cross on the highway leading from Ancy to Geneva, he answered by writing the defense of the standard of the Holy Cross. When those who sought his advice could not confer with him in person, he wrote letters to them. From such situations, his most famous book emerged. The direction of souls was always a principal activity in the life of St. Francis de Sales as a priest and a bishop. He was ready at all times to spend himself in the confessional to give personal instructions in preaching sermons and in writing letters. It was out of this great concern for the advancement and perfection of individual souls that the introduction grew. It is true that his friend, King Henry IV of France, encouraged and urged on the saint in his work of instructing the people in their religion, but it is not the case that the king inspired or originated the writing of the introduction to the devout life, as is sometimes stated. Its beginnings are found rather in the letters on spiritual subjects written by the saint to such friends as Madame de Chantal, to the abbess Rose Bourgeois, and to his own sister, Madame Brulart. It is especially to the character and needs of another of his penitents, Madame de Charmacy, that the introduction is due. Marie du Chastel, a maid of honor in the household of Catherine of Cleves, Dowager Duchess of Guise, had married in 1600 at Paris a relative of St. Francis de Sales, Claude de Charmacy, ambassador of the Duke of Savoy to the Republic of Béarn. After their marriage, Madame de Charmacy resided in Savoy, and because of a lawsuit, found it necessary to spend the early part of 1607 in Ancy. It was at this time that her spiritual direction was undertaken by the saint, who continued his instructions by letter. Madame de Charmecy herself has left an account of the origin of the introduction. At the beginning, when I placed my soul in the hands of the said servant of God, occasion arose for my return to court. As I was greatly apprehensive of this, I went to confer with the said servant of God, declaring to him my apprehensions. He then said to me, "Have courage, my child. Do not fear that on this account you will fall back. For if you are faithful to God, he will never fail you, even though he has to stop the sun and the moon. He will give you enough time to perform your exercises and all else that you must do." For this reason, he determined to give me some instructions in writing upon this subject, and these I communicated to a Jesuit father, who found them so excellent and useful that he urged the blessed servant of God to have them printed. This was the reason why he composed the Introduction to the Devout Life, into which book he inserted them. In a letter preserved at Annecy, St. Francis de Sales himself identifies the religious to whom Madame de Charmecy showed his letters. It was Père Jean Fourier, or Fourier, a member of the Society of Jesus. She showed it to the Reverend Father Fourier, then rector of the College of Chambéry, and now of that of Avignon, whom she knew to be my great friend and to whom, moreover, I offered and rendered an account of my deeds. It was he who urged me so strongly to publish these writings that after I had hastily reviewed them and made some little adjustments, I sent them to the printer. St. Francis worked on the introduction during 1607 and 1608 and gave it to the printer in August 1608. As the Privilège du Roi is dated November 10th, 1608, the earliest the book could have appeared is the end of the year 1608. However, the first edition bears the date 1609 on its title page. A second edition was called for in 1609 and a third in 1610. The second edition was defective, as St. Francis states in his foreword to the third. He had added new material to his book, but unfortunately three chapters that were in the original edition were inadvertently left out in the second. The popularity of the work is further seen in the fact that there were three printings of the second edition and many printings both of the third and the fourth editions, which appeared in 1616. Moreover, unauthorized editions were being put out. Always a careful writer, St. Francis found time to revise an Italian version of his book and also to give the French original a thorough revision. He was disturbed by the typographical errors in the earlier editions, some of them, as he said, due to himself, and some to the printer, and wished to leave behind him as accurate a copy of his work as he could. This final revision was made in Paris, where he spent the months from November 1618 to September 1619 as a member of an embassy sent from the court of Savoy to that of France. It is this edition that serves as the text for the critical edition put forth by Don B. Mackie and published in the third volume of the Annecy edition of the works of St. Francis de Sales. When the Introduction to the Devout Life first appeared, it was recognized as a masterpiece of mystical and devotional literature, and for more than three centuries, there has been no dissent from this judgment. Its greatness lies in many things, in its originality, its completeness, its sincerity, its balance, its penetration, and its style. It is one of those rare productions of human genius which are completely successful in what they wish to do. As such, it is beyond adverse criticism in any important way. The originality of the introduction lies not so much in its particular parts as in its entire conception. Perhaps it is true, as St. Francis says in his preface, that he does not say anything not already said by devotional writers, although we prefer to think that he errs in the way of modesty. But the principles and applications that are scattered throughout earlier authors are collected and systematized and synthesized in his work. It is because St. Francis de Sales saw the need of a work such as this introduction that he wrote it. That it is systematic and complete as well as original is seen by an examination of the table of contents. The greatest of his work is shown in what may be called the symmetry of the saint's thought. Throughout the work, the most delicate balance and the most perfect proportion are everywhere preserved. Everywhere he avoids the extremes that lead to danger or are themselves dangerous. His purpose is to arouse in his reader a complete love of God and an absolute confidence in him. This life of devotion is as open to the soldier, the shopkeeper, the courtier, the man of affairs, and the woman in the home as it is to the desert solitary and the nun in her cell. But to the diversity of men and women, he presents ways and means to attain holiness of life that are perfectly adapted to their varying conditions of life. What he urges upon all men and women is hatred of sin, detachment from the things of the world, love of God, and constancy in prayer to him. The beauty and the persuasive power of St. Francis' book are apparent even in translation. The warmth and charm of his character, his complete integrity, and his intensity of thought and feeling reveal themselves not only in what he writes, but in the way he writes as well. Clarity of thought reveals itself in clarity of language, and fullness of thought in fullness of expression. Familiarity with his subject makes the saint see countless parallels between it and what he has observed and read. Here indeed the critic may find a fault. St. Francis is a master at making comparisons that light up and enliven the subject at hand. Some of these analogies sound strange to our ears. They are drawn from authors like Pliny, who attributed to plants and animals powers and activities that a better natural history discounts or denies. Yet even in this, there is a charm that would be lost if strict fact replaced the fancies of an earlier day. So great and immediate was the success of the Introduction to the Devout Life that even during the author's lifetime, translations of it were made into the principal European languages. The first English translation appeared in 1613. One Latin translation appeared about 1612, and another was published at Cologne in 1614. A Spanish translation was published in 1618, and one into Flemish sometime earlier. St. Francis himself, in a letter written in 1610, mentions a translation into Italian, and later he assisted Padre Antoniti S.J. with his translation, which was published at Turin in 1621. When the first German translation was made is not known, but in 1627 there is mention that one was in use. By 1656, the work had been translated into 17 languages. Since then, countless editions of the work have appeared in various languages and dialects, including Irish, Basque, Bretonese, modern Greek, Armenian, Chinese, and Mexican. The history of the English translation of the Introduction to the Devout Life is full of interest and bears further testimony to the need and value of the work. The first translation was made by an English Benedictine named John Yeaworth. Its title page reads, An Introduction to a Devout Life, composed in French by the Our Father in God, Francis Sales, Bishop of Geneva, and translated into English by I. Y. Ruan, Hamilton, 1613. Yaworth's translation won a popularity as immediate as that of the original work. A second edition was put forth at Ruan in 1613, and a third in 1614. Other editions were published at London in 1616, at Paris in 1637, at Lyon without date, and at Dublin in 1673. Yaworth used the third, 1610 edition, of the Introduction for his translation, and hence it is not complete. As translators are often tempted to do, he took certain liberties with the original text. Thus he sought to improve upon St. Francis by changing Philotheia into Philotheus. Because of the shortcomings of Jaworth's translation, a new edition was put out by a group of English priests of Tournai College in Paris in 1648. The reasons for this edition are given in their preface. It has been formerly translated by a revered person of our country, but he, in his great humility, exposing it to the reviewing of others, it fell into the hands of some who, enlarging the author's style by many unnecessary paraphrases, have in diverse places confounded his sense and made the book less portable. In this edition, we hope to have remedied both these inconveniences. The first, by following the true sense of the author and his own expressions as near to the life as the two languages will meet. The second, by printing it in somewhat a less character than formerly. The title page reads, A New Edition of the Introduction to a Devout Life of B. Francis de Sales, together with a summary of his life and a collection of his choicest maxims, set forth by the English priest of Tournai College at Paris, 1648. This edition was reprinted in London in 1675, 1726, and 1741. It is this version that has been most widely read in English-speaking countries. It has been printed countless times in various places with changes in spelling, punctuation, and other details. It served as a basis for Bishop Richard Challoner's version, first published in London in 1762, and subsequently often reprinted. Since then, two further editions have been put forth, that of the Very Reverend W.J.B. Richards, London, 1848, and that of the Reverend Alan Ross, London, 1924, the latter of which is based upon the traditional translation. In addition to the numerous printings of the English translations of the introduction, there is other evidence of the widespread acceptance of the work and its subsequent influence. Marie de Medicis presented a copy in jeweled binding to King James I of England, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. William Laud, Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, executed by the Puritans in 1645, expressed his approval of the book. But by far, the most striking testimony to the introduction's power is found in the proclamation issued by King Charles I on May 14th, 1637, ordering that all copies in England be seized and burned. Happily, the connection of the Stuart family with the book does not end in this way. James II, the last Catholic King of England and the son of Charles I, gave order to a London printer in 1685 to prepare a special edition of the introduction for use by the royal family and in the royal chapel. His own son, the Old Pretender, in turn possessed and annotated a copy which is still preserved in the Visitation Convent in Paris. How widely the early editions of the translation were received among non-Catholics, it is impossible to say. Nevertheless, by the end of the 17th century, William Nichols, rector of the parish of Selsey in Sussex, saw an opportunity to prepare a special edition that would not be offensive to Protestants. The title page of his work reads, An Introduction to a Devout Life by Francis Sales, Bishop and Prince of Geneva, translated and reformed from the errors of the Popish edition, to which is prefixed a discourse of the rise and progress of the spiritual books in the Romish Church by William Nichols, D.D., London, printed by E. Holt for Theodore Bennett at the Half Moon in St. Paul's Churchyard and J. Sprint at the Bell in Little Britain, 1701. Nichols had high admiration for the introduction but took great liberties with it. In general, references to the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, Sacramental Confession, the Invocation of the Saints, Catholic prayers and devotions, and stories taken from the lives and legends of the saints are excised. A few chapters are omitted, and certain changes are made in the text, some of them minor and some serious. The present edition is based upon the traditional translations of John Yeaworth and the English priest of Tourney College, and upon the text of the original French work as established by Dom B. Mackey in the definitive ANSI edition. The attempt has been made to give a complete and accurate English rendition of the Introduction to the Devout Life. There has been no wish to depart from the thought of St. Francis de Sales in any detail, or to improve upon him in any manner. It is the present editor's hope to share in some slight way in the great aim that St. Francis de Sales had in writing this mystical and devotional masterpiece, that its readers may put this little book to good use and receive great blessings from it. Signed, John K. Ryan. We begin with St. Francis' dedicatory prayer. O sweet Jesus, my Lord, my Savior, and my God, behold me here prostrate before thy majesty, devoting and consecrating this work to thy glory. Give life to its words by thy blessings, that those souls for whom I have composed it may receive from it the sacred inspirations that I desire for them. And in particular, grant them that of imploring for me thine infinite mercy, to the end that while I point out to others the way of devotion in this world, I may not myself be eternally rejected and condemned in the other, but that with them I may forever sing as a canticle of triumph the words with which my whole heart I pronounce in testimony of my fidelity amidst the hazards of this mortal life. Live, Jesus, live, Jesus, yea, Lord Jesus, live and reign in our hearts forever and ever. Amen. The Author's Preface. My dear reader, I ask you to read this preface both for your satisfaction and for my own. Glycera, the bouquet maker, knew so well how to diversify and arrange her flowers that with the same flowers she made a great variety of bouquets. The painter Pausias, in attempting to imitate them, failed in his design, for he could not diversify his painting as variously as Glycera did her bouquets. It is in like manner that the Holy Spirit disposes and orders with so much variety the devout instructions that he gives to us by the tongues and pens of his servants. Although the doctrine is the same, the manner of treating it differs according to the several methods in which it is composed. I neither can nor will, nor indeed should I, write in this introduction anything different from what has already been published by our predecessors on this subject. The flowers that I present to you are the same, but the bouquet that I have made of them differs from theirs because it has been made up in a different order and way. Almost all those who have hitherto treated of devotion have had in view the instruction of persons wholly withdrawn from the world, or they have taught a kind of devotion that leads to this absolute retirement. My intention is to instruct those who live in towns, in families, or at court. By their condition, they are obliged to lead, as to outward appearances, an ordinary life. Frequently, under an imaginary pretense of impossibility, they will not so much as think of undertaking a devout life. It is their belief that just as no beast dares taste the seed of the herb called Palma Christi, so no man ought to aspire to the palm of Christian piety as long as he lives amidst the press of temporal affairs. To such I shall prove that as the mother of pearl fish lives in the sea without receiving a drop of salt water, and as near the Chalcedonian islands springs of fresh water may be found in the midst of the sea, and as the firefly passes through the flames without burning its wings, so a vigorous and resolute soul may live in the world without being infected by any of its moods, may discover sweet springs of piety amidst its salt waters, and may fly through the flames of earthly lusts without burning the wings of the holy desires of a devout life. It is true that this is a difficult task. That is why I wish that many would endeavor to accomplish it with more ardor than has hitherto been shown. Weak as I am, I shall endeavor by this treatise to contribute some little assistance to those who with a generous heart shall undertake so worthy an enterprise. Yet it is not through my own choice or inclination that this introduction is now made public. A pious and virtuous soul, who had some time since received from God the grace of aspiring to a devout life, desired my particular assistance for that purpose. Being under many obligations to her, and having long before discovered in her a warm disposition to piety, I applied myself very diligently to her instruction. Having conducted her through all the exercises suitable to her purpose and condition, I left her certain written notes of which she might occasionally make use. These she afterwards communicated to an important, learned, and devout religious. He believed that many might profit by their perusal, and earnestly requested me to have them published. To this I readily agreed, for the reason that his friendship had a great influence over my will, and his judgment held a great authority over my own. That the whole work might be more profitable and agreeable, I have revised and connected the different parts, adding certain advice and instructions that appeared suited to my intention. I have done all this with almost no leisure time. Hence you will find here nothing precise, but merely a collection of good advice, which I have delivered in plain and intelligible words, or at least that is what I have wished to do. With regard to literary ornaments, I have not even thought of them, having enough of other things to do. I address my discourse to Philothea, because from a desire to reduce what I had at first written for one only to the general advantage of many souls, I make use of a name applicable to all who aspire to devotion. For Philothea signifies a soul loving or in love with God. Considering then throughout this work a soul that by the desire of devotion aspires to the love of God, I have divided this introduction into five parts. In the first, I endeavor, by remonstrance and exercises, to convert Philothea's simple desire into a solid resolution. She at last makes this by a firm protestation after her general confession, followed by most holy communion, in which she gives herself up to our Savior and happily enters into his holy love. This done, to lead her further on, I show her the two great means by which she may unite herself more and more to his divine majesty: the use of the sacraments, by which our good God comes to us, and holy prayer, by which he attracts us to himself. It is to this that I devote the second part. In the third part, I show her how she ought to exercise herself in several virtues most needed for her advancement, not stopping except for some particular advice which she could hardly have received elsewhere or discovered for herself. In the fourth part, I expose to her view some of the snares of her enemies, showing her how she may escape them and proceed forward. In the fifth and last part, I cause her to retire a little in order to refresh herself, recover breath, and repair her strength, so that she may afterwards more happily gain ground and advance in a devout life. This age is very capricious. I foresee that many will say that it belongs only to members of religious communities and to persons dedicated to devotion to give particular directions concerning piety, that these things require more leisure than a bishop who is charged with a diocese so large as mine can have, and that such an undertaking too much distracts the mind, which should be employed in affairs of importance. But, dear reader, in company with the great Saint Dionysius, I tell you that it belongs principally to bishops to conduct souls to perfection, since their order is as supreme among men as that of the seraphim is among the angels. Hence, their leisure cannot be better employed than in this. The ancient bishops and fathers of the church were at least as careful of their charge as we are, yet they did not decline to superintend the particular conduct of several souls who had recourse to their assistance, as we see from their epistles. In these instances they imitated the apostles, who amidst the general harvest of the world picked up certain remarkable ears of corn with a special and particular affection. Who is ignorant that Timothy, Titus, Philemon, St. Tecla, and Appia were the dear disciples of the great Paul, as St. Mark and St. Petronella were of St. Peter? St. Petronella, I say, who, as Baronius and Galonius learnedly prove, was not St. Peter's physical, but only his spiritual daughter. And does not St. John write one of his epistles to the devout Lady Electa? It is painful, I grant, to give particular direction to souls, but it is a pain that gives comfort, like that felt by the laborers in the harvest and vineyard, who are never better pleased than when they have most to do and when their burdens are the heaviest. It is a labor that refreshes and revives the heart by the sweet delight that it excites in those who are engaged in it, just as the cinnamon refreshes those who carry it through Arabia Felix. It is said that when the tigress finds one of her whelps, which the huntsman leaves in the way to beguile her while he carries off the rest of her litter, she puts it upon her back, and yet does not feel herself encumbered. On the contrary, she is more active in the course that she takes to bring it safely to her den, for natural love lessens the weight of her burden. How much more willingly, then, will a fatherly heart take charge of a soul in which he has found a desire for holy perfection, carrying it in his bosom as a mother does her little child, without being wearied by so precious a burden. But his indeed must be a fatherly heart. Therefore the apostles and the apostolic men called their disciples not only their children, but still more tenderly, their little children. It is true, dear reader, that here I write of a devout life without being devout myself, yet it is certainly not without a desire of becoming so, and it is this affection for devotion that encourages me to instruct you. As a certain great man of letters has said, to study is a good way to learn, to hear is a still better way, but to teach is the best of all. It often happens, says St. Augustine, writing to his devout Florentina, that the office of distributing gives us the merit of receiving, and the office of teaching serves as a foundation for learning. Alexander caused the picture of the beautiful Campaspe to be drawn by the hand of the great Apelles. As Apelles was obliged to gaze upon Campaspe for a long time, even as he drew her features in his picture, he impressed his love for them upon his heart. At length he became so enamored with her that Alexander saw this, took pity on him, and gave her to him in marriage. Thus, for Apelles' sake, he deprived himself of the woman that he loved most in the world. In this action, says Pliny, he showed the greatness of his mind as much as he could have done by the most signal victory. Now I am of the opinion, dear reader, that it is the will of God that I, who am a bishop, should paint upon the hearts of his people not only the common virtues, but also his most dear and well-beloved devotion. I willingly undertake this work, both in obedience to him and to discharge my duty, and in the hope that by engraving this in the minds of others, my own may become enamored with her beauty. Now if God's divine majesty shall ever see me passionately in love with the devout life, he will give her to me in an eternal marriage. The beautiful and chaste Rebecca, when watering Isaac's camels, was destined to be his wife, and received on his behalf golden earrings and bracelets. Thus do I urge myself, through the infinite goodness of God, that while I conduct his dear sheep to the wholesome waters of devotion, He will make my soul his spouse, putting in my ears the golden words of his holy love, and in my arms strength to practice good works, in which consists the essence of true devotion. This I humbly beseech His Divine Majesty to grant to me and to all the children of His Church, to which I forever submit my writings, my actions, my words, my intentions, and my thoughts. ANSI, the Feast of St. Magdalene, 1609. The first part of the introduction, containing instructions and exercises necessary for conducting the soul from her first desire till she be brought to a full resolution to embrace a devout life. The description of true devotion. You aspire to devotion, dearest Philothea, because being a Christian, you know it to be a virtue extremely pleasing to the Divine Majesty. Since small faults committed in the beginning of any undertaking grow in the progress infinitely greater and become in the end almost irreparable, you must above all else know what the virtue of devotion is. There is but one true devotion, and there are many that are false and deceitful. Hence, if you cannot distinguish that which is true, you may easily deceive and distract yourself in following one that is offensive and superstitious. As Aurelius painted all the faces in his pictures in the manner and likeness of the woman he loved, so everyone paints devotion according to his own love and fancy. The man who is addicted to fasting thinks himself very devout if he fasts, though his heart be at the same time filled with rancor. He scruples to moisten his tongue with wine or even with water because of his sobriety, but he makes no difficulty of drinking deep of his neighbor's blood by detraction and calumny. Another considers himself devout because he recites daily a multiplicity of prayers, although immediately afterward he utters the most disagreeable, arrogant, and injurious words in his home and among his neighbors. Another cheerfully draws an alms out of his purse to give to the poor, but he cannot draw meekness out of his heart to forgive his enemies. Another readily forgives his enemies, but he never satisfies his creditors, except when compelled by the sharp power of the law. All these are commonly esteemed devout, while in reality they are by no means so. Saul's servants sought David in his house, but Michal laid a statue in his bed, covered it over with clothes, and made them believe that it was David himself. In the same manner, many persons, by covering themselves with certain external actions belonging to holy devotion, make the world believe that they are truly devout, whereas they are in truth nothing but images and phantoms of devotion. True living devotion, Philothea, presupposes the love of God, and hence it is nothing else than the love of God. But it is not always love as such. Inasmuch as divine love adorns a soul, it is called grace, which makes us pleasing to His Divine Majesty. Inasmuch as it gives us the strength to do good, it is called charity. When it has arrived at that degree of perfection by which it not only makes us do well, but also do this diligently, frequently, and readily, then it is called devotion. Ostriches never fly. Hens fly close to the ground, clumsily and only occasionally. But eagles, doves, and swallows fly aloft swiftly and frequently. In like manner, sinners fly not at all toward God, but make their whole course upon the earth and for the earth. Good people who have not as yet attained to devotion fly toward God by their good works, but infrequently, slowly, and clumsily. Devout souls ascend to Him by more frequent, prompt, and lofty flights. In short, devotion is nothing else than that spiritual agility and vivacity by which charity works in us, or we work by her aid with alacrity and affection. As it is the function of charity to make us observe of all of God's commandments in general, and without exception, so it is the part of devotion to make us observe them more quickly and with diligence. Wherefore, the man who does not observe all the commandments of God cannot be esteemed either good or devout. For to be good, he must be possessed of charity, and to be devout, in addition to charity, he must show a cheerfulness and alacrity in the performance of charitable actions. As devotion consists in a certain degree of eminent charity, it not only makes us active and diligent in the observance of God's commandments, but beyond this, it arouses us to do quickly and lovingly as many good works as we can, both those commanded and those that are merely counseled and inspired. Just as a man newly recovered from an illness walks only as much as is necessary for him, but yet slowly and with difficulty, so a sinner, just healed of his iniquity, walks as far as God commands him, but slowly and with difficulty, until such time as he attains to devotion. Then, like a man in sound health, he not only walks, but runs and leaps forward in the way of God's commandments. Moreover, he moves and runs in the paths of his heavenly counsels and inspirations. To conclude, charity and devotion differ no more from each other than does the flame from the fire, for charity is a spiritual fire which, when inflamed, is called devotion. Hence it appears that devotion adds nothing to the fire of charity, but the flame that makes it ready, active, and diligent, not only in the observance of the commandments of God, but also in the execution of his heavenly counsels and inspirations. Let us continue our introduction to the devout life on Side B.